Hello and welcome to The Way I See It, and my name is Vanessa Coleman. Once again today I'm going to read a few articles from things that have caught my eye in the last week. The first one is entitled, Lord Leech and Open Europe. Only big picture reform will keep Britain in the EU. And this was in The Independent by Margareta Pagano. When Rodney Leech was a young classics tutor at Oxford, he started the Oxford Hungarian Relief Fund, helping refugees oppressed by the Russian invasion of 1956. He was 22 and says the experience made him feel rather, as Wordsworth may have done, during the early days of the French Revolution. I hesitate to use the comparison, but it must have been a similar feeling. Watching the Hungarians resisting the Russians was a revelation. Here were people longing to be free. To my surprise, I found I had a deep desire to do something real for the liberation of the human spirit. Our times changes. Today, Hungary is closing its borders to refugees and migrants trying to escape barbaric circumstances, and the paradox is not lost on him. It's awful to watch the pictures of barbed wire going up across borders. German Chancellor Angela Merkel made a good-hearted blunder when she said Germany would open its doors to the refugees. Predictably, she is now facing a backlash. You can understand why countries in the front line are desperate to stop a free-for-all. What's more, Lord Leech describes as nuts the recent proposal from Jean-Claude Juncker, President of the European Commission, that each country in the European Union should take a quota of 120,000 refugees. The situation is growing seriously muddled and dangerous because no one knows exactly whether the people arriving are real refugees or immigrants. Many are from Africa and Asia, not from the Syrian war zone. Sadly, the emoting from religious leaders and the Bien peasants to open our doors to more refugees is making matters worse. We are talking in one of the meeting rooms at 3 Lombard Street, the London end of Jardines, the hotels to engineering to insurance trading empire controlled by the Keswick family. Lord Leech has worked for Jardines as an advisor for 32 years, helping the family business to steer its way through the Hong Kong handover and to construct the complex cross-ownership share structure that makes a hostile takeover almost impossible. Impeccably dressed in dark blue pinstripe suit and knitted black waistcoat, he has the air of a hawk. He shoots me the most outraged stare when, foolishly, I ask whether he still works full-time at Jardine. He is 81. Of course I work every day. Strategic issues never go away, and Jardine's is a very collaborative business. Lord Leech has another advisory role as chairman of Open Europe, the think tank he founded in 2008, to put the case for reforming Britain's relationship with the EU. He has a good track record in lobbying, having chaired the Business for Stirling campaign group 15 years ago, when the Blair government was on the verge of taking the UK into the Eurozone. Such is Open Europe's reputation for robust thinking that Mats Persson, its former chief executive, is now in the number 10 policy unit advising on the referendum. Indeed, Lord Leech says that both the outers, led by groups such as Business for Britain, and the inners, like Business for New Europe, have sought Open Europe's cooperation to bolster the credibility of the case they put to the public. Although a Conservative peer, he says he's not remotely interested in party politics. only philosophical principles. What we have done is point out certain truths, explaining rationally what is going on beneath the surface, just as we did with Business for Sterling. We have a handful of brilliant policy analysts. They will always outgun 100 or so middling economists. As think tanks go, we live on a shoestring and spend about £700,000 a year. Right now, Lord Leach says the momentum is with the No lobby because of the migrant crisis, and before it, the Eurozone crisis and Greece. But this is changing hour by hour, even as we speak. British opinion is on a knife edge. The public is exhausted by too many superficial polls. Our research suggests that 25% is fixed for the inners and 25 to 30% for the outers. This leaves nearly half the electorate leaning this way or that, but essentially still undecided. For him, David Cameron and George Osborne will only win if they negotiate big picture reform with the EU, halting the current inexorable direction of travel towards an EU superstate. Even Otmar Issing, one of the Euro's founding fathers, warns that the latest plan for the EU-wide finance ministry, with control over tax and spending, is a foolhardy attempt to smuggle through political union and breaches the basic fundamentals of modern democracy. There are two big changes, Lord Leach says, that would constitute a good deal. The first step would be to redefine the EU as the single market, not as a vague aspiration to political union, with safeguards put in place to ensure that as the Eurozone integrates, it does not write the rules for the rest of the member states. We need to establish a principle that allows countries to choose whether they want to be in closer union with each other or, like Britain and possibly some Nordic countries and Poland, those that want a Europe of nation states inside the EU but outside the Eurozone. If some countries want to advance towards economic and political unity through what's called enhanced cooperation, whether it's currency union or passports or defence or employment or even tax, then let them. That's fine, so long as we are not forced to. You can see countries like Norway and Switzerland joining such a structure, and the Turkish issue would become more soluble. Second, he would like to pull back some powers over EU decisions to Westminster. The best news I've heard for a long time is that Cameron and the new Polish president share similar views on national sovereignty. There has been a shameful neglect of Poland for years by previous governments, and so it's wonderful to see closer relations. He is sympathetic to the dreams of the EU's founding fathers, yet suggests Europe has changed so much that many of those early ideals are no longer pertinent. Democracy failed the people during the 20th century, which was a series of economic disasters and a bloody period of history with two world wars, the Spanish Civil War and then Soviet communism. Today, Europe is very different. There has been a revival of democracy. New legitimate states are coming out of our ears. There are now 60 proper democracy compared with 16 after the Second World War. Europe's dynamics have changed, and so have the world's dynamics with the massive entry of Asia into the global economy and the substitution of regional groupings by the networked international village. However, he says the outers, who claim that reaching a favourable free trade deal with the EU will be virtually automatic since Europe needs us more than we need them, are mistaken. If they believe the EU will make it easy for the UK to negotiate new free trade agreements for services, which is Britain's strength, they are deluded. The city would not be hit as hard as the Europhiles claim, but it would not escape unscathed. In theory, agreements on physical trade are a credible alternative to the single market. But they would take time to negotiate, and in the meantime, continental manufacturers and suppliers would see no advantage in suspending their competitive instincts just to help us out. As he points out, the EU has been very reluctant to embrace free markets in services, and some of the Eurozone's attacks on the city these past few years have been blatant and quite brutal. The French would not be alone in harbouring an ambition to block British finances from ready access to EU markets. The elephant in the room is defence, Lord Leech says. The UK represents about half the EU's military capacity, and it's a strong negotiating arm for us to use, particularly with the French, with whom we have similar military strength. As far as I can tell, the politicians are not playing this card, and that's a pity. Mind you, that doesn't surprise me, as most European and British politicians have enough on their plate already. He says Miss Merkel knows the UK leaving would be bad for her, leaving Germany on its own negotiating with the southern countries, but also losing nearly 15% of the EU's budgetary contributions, its financial powerhouse and its principal channel to the Anglophone world, as well as the main opponent of protectionism. What does he think about the recent brouhaha over the wording of the referendum question? It's irrelevant. Can anyone remember what the yes vote was for in the Scottish referendum? Was it for staying in the UK or for independence? Most people don't remember. All this fuss is hyperventilation, and frankly, I don't give a bugger. Nor do I care whether the referendum is called tomorrow or in 2017. What's important is that we get serious concessions and the arguments are put to the British public calmly and not frantically overstated, as they are now by the two opposing camps. If the government doesn't get the right reforms, then Britain is merely deferring an exit at a later stage. The next article I'm reading is called Migrant Crisis from The Guardian. Europe hasn't seen anything yet, and it's by Douglas Murray. What is now being called Europe's migrant crisis is far more than that. It is in fact a crisis of European thought and of political leadership. At the heart of this crisis are the irreconcilable feelings of the European publics, the problems of a European political class trying to found policies based on those contradictions and a continent-wide unwillingness to think this crisis through beyond short-term emotionalism to any of its logical endpoints. The first of these problems, the contradictions of the public, has been most evident in recent weeks. In late August, in the eastern German town of Heidenau, there were protests outside a refugee centre and an arson attack on a facility to be used by migrants. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, announced that Germany would accept around 800,000 refugees, about 1% of the current German population, this year. When she subsequently appeared in Heidenau, Merkel was roundly booed and heckled by the crowds. This was understandably not the image that many other Germans wished to give to the world. Only days later, as refugees flowed across the borders of Germany, there were almost euphoric scenes as people lined the way, clapping, doling out toys, and in some places, throwing what appeared to be a carnival for their new arrivals. Yet these two groups of people are not wholly separate entities, but rather represent a confusion which goes through the heart of many Europeans. Because, of course, when we in Europe see people fleeing across borders, we think of those who fled from country to country as refugees from Nazi Germany and scoured the globe for anyone to take them in. Our immediate instinct is compassion and, in some cases, guilt. Yet emotion is not enough and little enough. And while journalists compete to find the worst horror stories from those escaping from Syria, few people, if any, are asking the questions behind the emotions. Here are just a few of the questions we still cannot answer. Is Syria really like Nazi Germany? To date, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan, among other countries, have grudgingly taken in many refugees. But is the choice for Syria's exiled populations really Europe or death? Even if it was, would Europe be able to take in millions of Syrian refugees? What will we do once they are here? Do we have any jobs for them or places for them to live? If they come here, will they ever return to their country once the war is over? Could temporary asylum even exist, given that most people will enter the welfare system and their children access schooling and other undoable provisions? In truth, these questions are the simplest of all, because this is not the problem in full, but only a portion of it. We are failing to deal with even a portion of the problem. Of the migrants who now form the largest inflow of migrants into Europe in recent history, only around 40% are Syrians. We have lasered in on the Syria portion of this problem, but it is only part of the problem. Most of those currently coming into Europe, as I saw on a recent trip to the Italian Mediterranean island of Lampedusa, are from elsewhere in the world, including sub-Saharan Africa and in particular Eritrea. Even if it were in Britain or Europe's gift to bring peace to Syria, what is the plan to bring stability and prosperity to Eritrea? Has anybody anywhere got any idea? The British Home Secretary, Theresa May, recently said that Britain and other countries must try to improve living standards in such countries to prevent people coming here. But the truth is, as many studies have shown, it is only when living standards rise that the migration truly begins. Truly poor people do not have the money to bribe the smugglers. Even here, we are far beyond the current acceptable political discussion, yet barely scratching the surface of the problem. But the questions have to be asked. What system does Europe have in place to discern who is a legitimate refugee and who is an economic migrant? Is it fit for purpose? In Italy, I asked every aid worker I could find if they knew of anybody being sent back home after arriving in European waters. Nobody could think of such a case. The truth is that once someone is here, they stay because Europe cannot work out who is who. Most people having deliberately come without papers. And even if they are clearly economic migrants, they are never sent home. Europe had no workable system to do this when the movement was at a low point. Now that it is at a historic high, Europe has less than no system. And then there is the question of the composition of the migrants. If this movement is indeed a movement of the genuinely dispossessed, then why are almost all of them young men? In recent weeks, the media has zoomed its cameras in on the occasional woman or child, but they are the rarities. On Lampedusa, I saw only young men from sub-Sahara Africa. I saw no women. One of the first things that many of the rivals did on getting to the island was to buy a SIM card and call home to tell their families they had made it. Families they will end up sending money to if they make any, and whom they will often aim to bring over to join them. And of course, there is the question of integration. Does anybody anywhere in Europe still think integration has happened to date? Almost every government currently opening its borders to further migrants has in fact accepted that it has not. Chancellor Merkel said as much in a speech 5 years ago as David Cameron did 4 years ago. So why would integration happen when immigration is at the current historical highs? If it didn't happen when immigration was at remarkably a comparatively low, some politicians want to blame the public for a lack of enthusiasm about importing millions more people into Europe. If they're looking for someone to blame for that attitude, they could do worse than looking to the citizens of Dewsbury, Gennevilliers, Malmo, and many other places in Europe anyone can name. All of this, again, barely touches the beginning of the debate, which our continent is so far away from having. But perhaps it brings me to the most crucial question of all. Assuming that the majority of the arrivals are economic migrants, and that we are going to do little or nothing to prevent them coming, ought not Europeans to try to start thinking their way through the first principles questions, such as, is it the job of Europeans to give a better standard of living in our continent to anybody in the world who wants it? If public opinion polls are anything to go by, it would seem that the publics of Europe already have an answer to a question their political representatives still dare not ask. In Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, and other countries, politicians are trying to respond to public sentiment. But everywhere else, the strain of sustaining the current disconnect is beginning to show. The Swedish government recently announced that it is going to take a further 80,000 refugees this year, around 1% of its current population. It is a continuation of a more than generous asylum policy, which has seen Sweden boast of becoming a humanitarian superpower. But these things have consequences. One recent poll showed the only anti-immigration party in the country, the Sweden Democrats, for the first time leading the opinion polls. This party, often described as far right, was still, until recently, never polling above low single digits. In late August, the official immigration statistics for the UK were released and showed that Cameron's 2011 boast that his government would bring net immigration into the UK down from the hundreds of thousands a year to the tens of thousands has been missed by more than ever. The figures showed that net migration into the UK had actually reached an historic peak, rising to 330,000 up to the start of this year. We know how few people welcome this because poll after poll tells us so. One poll carried out last year found that a mere 11% of the UK population want the population to increase. Another recent poll showed that just 7% of the British public want more immigration to our country. Now that 13% of the UK population were not born in the UK, one interesting thing this shows is that even most immigrants to Britain do not want more immigrants. In the initial part of the current crisis, Cameron tried to reflect British public opinion. He stood against the demands of Merkel and the European Commission that European countries take quotas, even as they conceded that the quotas were insufficient to address the problem. But then the internal contradictions of Europe were demonstrated again by what most seem to agree was a turning point. The photograph of a dead Syrian boy, Aylin Kurdi, washed up on the shores of Turkey. A social media campaign grew, like the Bring Back Our Girls hashtag of a couple of years ago about Nigerian girls kidnapped by Boko Haram. This time the hashtag was Refugees Welcome, and celebrities, politicians and others photographed themselves with the sign and sent the photograph around on social media. Public and media opinion grew militant, simultaneously demanding slashes in net migration and vast increases in the number of refugees. The political class understandably struggled to keep pace with these contradictory demands. Soon the Hungarian government was being sat upon from above, and every voice of caution seemed to be on the defensive. To be opposed to letting in refugees was suddenly to be indifferent to the fate of dead children. Unsurprisingly, the British Prime Minister buckled and agreed to start by allowing in a further 20,000 Syrian refugees. Dams broke elsewhere in Europe too, with media cameramen running alongside migrants as they poured through the fields and across the borders. Over the next 48 hours, the New York Times reported a surge of migrant movement from Nigeria and elsewhere, as people saw that a window of opportunity had opened for citizenship in Europe. The Sun, meanwhile, responded to the photo of the drowned Syrian boy by drumbeating for RAF airstrikes inside Syria. And the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, used the opportunity to lambast the Labour Party for voting against intervention in Syria 2 years ago, describing it as one of the worst decisions the House of Commons has ever made. Few knee-jerks could more adequately sum up our confusion. For the 2013 Commons vote proposed a set of punitive airstrikes against the Assad regime for its use of chemical weapons in the Syrian civil war. As some of us who opposed those airstrikes said at the time, there was no strategic thinking about this and no thinking whatsoever about what Britain would do if those strikes helped topple Assad and left Britain, which had previously had no involvement in Syria's descent into chaos, with at least some responsibility for putting the country back together again. Those purported strikes had nothing to do with ISIS, would have done nothing to stem the flow of refugees from Syria, and might easily have made the refugee flow even larger. Like all the responses, public, media and political, this one was shot through with mistakes, zigzags and incorrect assumptions. If Europe is going to find its way through the current crisis, we will first have to find our way through these misperceptions. But like peeling an onion, it is going to require care and undoubtedly cause tears. First, we need to address the idea of our alleged responsibility for this crisis. Much, though many British people are willing to berate the former Labour government for its 2003 intervention in Iraq, our country has notably had extremely limited military involvement in Syria. Qatar and the UAE, two countries which have set up quotas to accept precisely no Syrian refugees, certainly have done. And Iran, whose Hezbollah and other militia have been fighting for Iranian interests in Syria for at least 4 years now, has now even berated Europe for not doing more. In early September, Iran's President Rouhani had the gall to lecture Hungary's ambassador to Iran over Hungary's shortcomings in the refugee crisis. Saudi Arabia, which has made no Syrians into Saudi citizens, has been backing its preferred sides inside the country. It has also refused to allow the use of 100,000 air-conditioned tents used only for 5 days a year by pilgrims on the Hajj. But the Saudis have offered to build 200 new mosques in Germany. Explaining the failure of Gulf countries to take in Syria refugees, one Kuwaiti official said, "In the end, it is not right for us to accept a people that are different from us. We don't want that people suffer from internal stress and trauma in our country."
Throughout most of human history, it has been easier for people to refuse rather than accept responsibility for things that they have done. Only in the modern West have we landed in the unnatural position of finding it easier to accept responsibility for things we have not done than to profess the truth of our innocence. But there are even worse truths underneath all this, not least the fact that even our best policies are unattainable. If this has been clear for some time, it is only making itself felt now. The problem might be summed up in the economic migrant/asylum-seeker debate. For the consensus that a lot of mainstream centre-ground politicians in Europe have come to is that the jury is out or unpersuaded by the cause of economic migrants, but that all asylum seekers must come in, pretending that we could invent tomorrow an instrument to perfectly differentiate between the two. Even that policy is impossible. Consider one example. European law dictates that people fleeing a country because of persecution for their faith, race, or sexual orientation, to give just three examples, will be given asylum if they can find their way to Europe. If the number of gay men and women in Africa and the Middle East is, as there is no reason to think it is not, around the same percentage it is in other societies, then that means, just for starters, that around 5% of the populations of those countries should, providing they can find their way here, be given asylum in Europe. We do know that this is not possible, don't we? But we pretend it is. Pretense based on the quiet hope that they will not find their way here. But what if they do? What if all those people our policy assumed wouldn't come here now do? The problem of not facing up to any of these failures of thought is that they stop our politicians being able to think their way through to any political leadership. One question I ask politicians whenever I get a chance is, why do they not do now the things which they will end up having to do at some point down the line? If you speak with Australian officials who dealt with a similar refugee boat crisis in their country last decade, they will tell you that you have to keep the migrants out of your country and dissuade others from coming. The Australian example is not a perfect match with the current European one, but it is close. The Australians set up holding centres outside Australian territory so that people could not land in the country and claim asylum once there. If European politicians were responsible, they would now be doing what they will end up having to do anyway, and pay North African countries and others to have holding centres where the claims of the various migrants can at least aim to be assessed. Stop them from setting foot in Europe, and you can prevent them all claiming every right, which will most likely allow them to remain in Europe in perpetuity. We must also consider what is best for the migrants in question. Even if we agree that life inside Syria is unlivable for much of the population, a sensible policy would be based on the fact, discussed by David Goddard and Paul Collier in their recent seminal works, that it is almost always better to keep somebody in proximity to the country from which they are fleeing. If somebody is fleeing Syria, it is far better that they stay in Jordan than that they are plonked down in Scandinavia. For sure, there are few job prospects for such refugees in Jordan. There may be fewer still in Scandinavia. But as Collier has argued, one solution is for European countries to do more to provide employment opportunities for Syrians inside neighbouring countries rather than a continent away. It is also vital for Europeans to consider what this crisis is not. The father of the Syrian boy who drowned on the shores of Turkey had a job in Turkey, and the family had been living there for 3 years at the time. He now blames Canada for the death of his son, because Canada did not immediately take his family in. Like many European countries, Canada, where I am sitting at the time of writing, is uncertain how much to beat itself up over this. A Holocaust survivor I sat beside at a dinner in Toronto expressed her horror at the repetition of history. But the situations are not analogous. The Syrian father's job may not have been the best job in the world, but his family's situation was not remotely analogous to the situation of a German Jew in the 1930s. A German Jew of that time who had managed to move to Sweden and get a job did not have transport provided to deliver him to Britain. But in the spreading around of the German reaction to all this, you can see something else working itself out. For the motivation in whole swathes of the West is a misreading of current and historical events. But this is not even the worst misunderstanding. That must be saved for the economic justification which has once again emerged. It is an argument which has been heard among Germans at the train station receptions and elsewhere. And it was expressed just last month by the EU head of the International Organization for Migration in the pages of the Wall Street Journal Europe. A more reckless argument is impossible to find. Eugenio Ambrosi argued that it was troubling that the continent was having difficulty accepting the unprecedented wave of migrants and claimed Europe is experiencing the most widespread and intense anti-immigrant sentiment seen in decades. But he went on to argue that migrants bring new ideas and high motivation and pitch in and contribute to our economies and societies when given a fair chance. Sometimes they have a better work ethic than native Europeans. Here is the crux. Europe is getting older and will soon be dealing with a serious shortage of working age people. Germany alone could experience a labour shortage of up to 2.4 million workers by 2020, according to the Boston Consulting Group. Our existing social security systems are not threatened by migration, quite to the contrary. The contribution of migrants will ensure that the support Europeans receive now will continue into the future. Lest anybody missed it, this is an argument for cultural suicide, dressed up in the language of palliative care. Even if Europe's demographic fall-off were as severe as Mr. Ambrosia claims, who but a madman would think the answer is to import people from a wholly different culture to make up the next generation? Do Ambrosi and other free marketeers in America and Europe really foresee no problems at all in this? Perhaps they should explain their theory to the 25 to 50% of young people in Spain, Portugal, Italy and Greece who do not have a job. Tell them that they have just been leapfrogged by people willing to work harder for less, with the approval of American free marketeers and assorted libertarians. Many of us who live in Europe love Europe as it is. We do not want our politicians, through weakness, cowardice or prevarication, to change our home into an utterly different place. Europeans may be almost endlessly compassionate, but not to the point of being suicidal. The public may want contradictory things, but they will not forgive politicians if, whether by accident or design, they change our continent completely. If they do so, then many of us will regret this quietly. Others will regret this less quietly. In either case, if our politicians do not start to lead their publics through this morass, then our continent's crisis may just be beginning. Wow, that was some article, wasn't it? A lot to take in. Anyway, I hope, like me, you've learnt a lot from these articles, and that's all for now, except to say that if you would like to meet Paul Perrin and myself, we are having a fundraising event in Bournemouth on Saturday, the 10th of October at noon. So if you're interested, please get in touch. And in the meantime, have a great day. Until the next time. Bye for now.